Legacy Committee meeting, starting with former Senator Steve Morse.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the Legacy Committee. I greatly appreciate this opportunity to visit with you today, and I'm fully confident that everybody who is not here will listen to all of this in detail on the tapes afterwards. So
we'll tell them.
Thank you. Madam Chair, as indicated, my name is Steve Morse. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Environmental Partnership, and we are the state's largest coalition of environmental and conservation groups, comprised of over 70 various organizations across the state. I'm going to make some overview comments about the Clean Water Land and Legacy Amendment with some specific attention to the Clean Water Fund to frame up this discussion. And then also with me is Cheryl Appledorn with Conservation Minnesota, who will be making comments after me. First, let me just back up and say, as I think you all know, November 4th, 2008, when the Legacy Amendment was enacted, was a great day. And it was really an important, auspicious day for the state of Minnesota in that it indicated that Minnesotans were willing to step up to protect their habitat, their water, their parks, trails, arts for future generations. And they're willing to pay to do that even in a downturn, in tough economic times, where people voted to increase their sales tax by 0.375%, even though we were just kind of falling off that cliff, you remember, in November of 2008, to start what came to be known as the Great Recession. But it's also important to remember that in 2008, that was the culmination of nearly 10 years worth of effort by a tremendous cross-section of groups, a very broad coalition that started by some of our friends in the hunting and fishing community, working with parks and trails and broadening out to the arts, and ultimately including a major component of water. As many of you remember, in those 10 years leading up to the ballot question, these different coalitions kind of ebbed and flowed. And when we got to the ballot question, because there were such different and distinct audiences, you remember that we had the Hooks and Bullets folks, and we had the environmental folks, and we had the arts and cultural folks. And you may remember there were actually three bumper strips during the campaign. There was the blaze orange for the hunting and fishing, and the green for the environmental groups, and then the blue for the arts and cultural people. But what's amazing is, although there are some great differences between those groups, they're very much united, much like Minnesotans overall, underneath this banner of increasing the sales taxes for this tremendous thing called the Legacy Amendment. Since it's been passed, we've had some tremendous impacts. We're going to hear about those today, from flagship projects like preservation of the headwaters in the Mississippi River to smaller projects working on cleanup and water protection in watersheds across the state of Minnesota. What we're going to focus on today primarily is water and the impacts of the Clean Water Fund and the water components of the Legacy Amendment. I want to spend just a minute talking about the water components because these two have a long history dating back at least to 2003 when the state became aware of what a backlog the state was facing in setting up and dealing with the Clean Water Act and the TMDLs, which are required for a watershed cleanup, which is basically testing and restoration work on a watershed-by-watershed basis that's required under the Clean Water Act. In 2003, there was a stakeholders process set up that became known as the G16. That was an iterative process that went on for a number of years and basically came up with a recommendation that we need $80 to $100 million in 2003 dollars to address the needs at that time for the waters that were on the list to be cleaned up. That was 2003, so that's more than a decade ago. As that process moved forward, ultimately the G16 worked on a piece of legislation called the Clean Water Legacy Act, and people oftentimes get that confused with the Clean Water Land and Legacy Amendment, but the Legacy Act passed in 2006, and that basically laid out the framework for how we would work together to implement a statewide cleanup strategy for testing, evaluating, coming up with cleanup plans, and then working to restore our lakes, rivers, and streams to a state that is healthy and consistent with these clean water standards. That passed in 2006. The Legacy Act went on the amendment in 2008. The Legacy Amendment, went on the ballot in 2008. And as you recall, 56% of the people casting a ballot that year voted in favor of raising their taxes in tough economic times to support these legacy purposes. If you look at just those who voted on the amendment itself, it was actually 59% of the people who voted for it. And one of the things that's interesting is, as Minnesota Environmental Partnership, we do polling at least once a year. And we did polling shortly after the election to test the question of why people voted for the amendment. We had lots of theories as to why we thought they would, but we said, well, let's go out and ask people. And one of the messages that came home loud and true was the overarching message of the campaign, which was 4 out of 10 of our waters don't meet basic health standards. We need to do something about that. That overall message that was used by the hunting and fishing community, the environmental community, the arts community, really resonated with the public. Because when we asked people why they voted for it, the number one reason, more than all the other specific reasons cited independently, the number one reason they said they voted for it was to protect and restore the state's waters. 42% of the people who voted for it said that's the reason, the single reason. And it's way more than all the other single reasons put together. So it was a driving force in actually the election, the campaign, and why people voted the way they did. I want to take us fast forward a little bit to where we are now, and we just completed a poll last month, and I believe you have a packet with some of this polling information, and I included a little bit on the methodology here because it was a statewide poll and the methodology is important. We had a total of 600 samples statewide, and for those of you who get into this polling stuff, it was a bipartisan research team, and we actually used the same team that we've used going back to the 2008 amendment. So it's a Republican firm that works nationally and a democratically aligned firm that works nationally, and they work nearly full-time on conservation and energy issues around the country, so they know these issues really, really well. And instead of asking, as we've done in the last number of years, about how the money should be used and how it should be distributed and to what types of projects it should be go to, we just thought we'd back up a little bit and just check in with the people after 5 years and say, it doesn't really matter if you voted for the question or not. And you'll see that it's spelled out there. We do a little bit of background, and then we ask the question on the third page of the handout. Whether you supported it or not, how do you currently feel about the constitutional amendment? And what you'll see is we came up from a 56% passage rate to a full 71% of the public that now says that they support the legacy amendment. And I think that is educational for all of us, because it's always tough to pass a tax. But because of the tremendous impact this legacy amendment has had so far, the public is saying, we really support this. And not only do they support it, but what's just as interesting is those that strongly support it. We're up at 40%, which is really a kind of a threshold tipping point for on social issues. When you have 40% of the public feeling strongly about something, that's usually enough to move the public in that direction.
Well, I'm looking at page 3 of the poll.
Yes.
Does that mean we really ought to throw 45% of the Republican, 54% of the Republican men on this committee off it?
Madam Chair, I
1, 2 Oh, sorry.
I couldn't help putting in a little bit of the demographic information, because I think it is important to see, who supports it and who doesn't. And
I have been told that if you go to my, it's beyond my technical abilities, but if you go to my house on Google Maps and you go in, you see the 1 sign for the legacy amendment.
Oh, really? What color was it?
It was, wasn't it just like this?
I think there were blue ones and orange ones and green ones.
It wasn't an orange one. Representative Torkel.
Madam Chair, I suggest we take that vote right now. Because if you look around the room, we have a majority of Republican men sitting at the table, armed and ready to vote.
That's obviously, because we need you here. You need to understand why you should.
My interpretation, Madam Chair, would be somewhat different. We're here because we care.
And Madam Chair, I would point out that 45% of Republican men do support the amendment. And the real point of that slide was just pretty much every demographic group that you look at. If you look at women, look at different ages, support the amendment. Democrats you know, overwhelmingly. Independents, absolutely overwhelmingly. And Republicans are kind of mixed, but it's really women, Republican women strongly support it. Republican men, a little bit on the negative side. But actually, even that's pretty close. And the real point of that is that across the playing field, across the landscape, there's strong support for this now, and it's grown tremendously from where it was 5 years ago. And we have contact information on the back. The second point I'd like to make, Madam Chair, is the excerpt as a couple of comments from the letter that's attached behind the polling information. After this amendment passed in 2008, we went into the 2009 legislative session, and a number of groups that had been working on this got together and said, well, you know, how do we really measure some of this stuff now? And how do we know what makes sense, what doesn't make sense, particularly around this question of substitution and supplanting? And you'll see in this letter, and what I did is just, because it's a little bit of a look backwards, we excerpted a few portions of a 2009 letter that went to Governor Pawlenty on this very issue. And it was a letter that was signed by a broad cross-section of groups, hunting, fishing, conservation groups, and we've done a number of these, including with the arts community. It has the constitutional language in here that says money under this section must supplement traditional sources of funding for these purposes and may not be used as a substitute. And then what we did as a community is laid out three tests that we think are still valid today, and that's why we just want to call them to your attention. We refer to them frequently and periodically as how do we kind of at the macro level, not looking necessarily fund by fund, but how do we step back and say, are we moving in the right direction in this? Is there substitution occurring, and or are we supplementing as the Constitution actually intends? And the three tests we came up with deal with the three different major areas of funding that we deal with. The first is the general fund. And the test is, you know, in recent years, our piece of the pie for environmental conservation program has steadily shrunk. And Cheryl Appledorn will talk about this in more detail. But basically, we said when we passed that amendment in 2008, we ought to hold our own at our share. And that was at about 1%. And so basically we're saying, if we are holding true to what the public intended, which is we have what we have now and we want to add to that to get a bump up in conservation spending, then we should keep our proportional share of the pie. So that's the first time. That's the first test. We're at a very low level at that point, a 30-year low. Let's hold us where we are as it, when the amendment passed. The second test is we have a number of dedicated funds in the Constitution, in the environmental conservation area, hunting and fishing fees, water fees, other environmental fees. We have to leave those alone. We can't raid those for other purposes and say that we're not raiding one part as we're putting money in someplace else, which would, in fact, be a substitution. And so we have to leave those alone. And I'm happy to say that so far the legislature and the governor have been really good on that. We've really stayed away from raiding these other dedicated funds, statutorily dedicated funds, since the amendment passed. And the third is something that's really on the table this year, is capital investments. Ms. Appledorn here has spent a lot of time going back over at least 10 years prior to that, looking at how much is consistently invested in an apples-to-apples comparison on capital investments into environment and conservation programs. And we took that and said, you know, we've averaged a little over 22% per biennium over the last 10 years. And if we're going to be true to the voters and true to the expression of their will, we should keep that percentage going forward. Because we know, and you'll hear about this today, the demands on these funds is far outstripping the funds that we have available. So this amendment is not about taking away what we've been doing in the past, but adding to it. So in order to continue that tradition, we've said, you know, we really need to keep 22% of the capital budget going to environmental conservation programs. And we've done, historically, since the amendment passed, fairly well in that category. And again, Ms. Appledorn will give us more details on that. So we've laid out these three tests, and we remind you of them pretty much every year. Those of you who have been around for a while have seen letters, have seen us testify, have seen reminders of that every year. And they may not be perfect benchmarks, but they're the only benchmarks that we've really seen put out there as a way to really assess this. And we're certainly open to looking at others, but we put these out, and really no one else has come up with a meaningful and consistent and long-term measure to date. So we put those forward for your consideration, and Cheryl will talk about those in a little bit more detail.
Represent- Well, let's
go ahead.
Representative Irwin, you don't mind being interrupted.
Nope, I don't mind being interrupted. I have one more point to finish up.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm just wondering, are those three tests being met in your estimation?
Madam Chair, Representative, in part, and Ms. Appledorn will get into that, we're not doing as well as we should on the state general fund. We continue to chip away at that. We're doing well on number two, and on number three, historically, we've done well, but this biennium is still an open question.
Madam Chair.
Representative Ertle.
Thank you. Just wondering, you know, 22% of the capital budget. I serve on the Capital Investment Committee as well, and wondering, you know, what types of projects are included in that. Wastewater projects, clean water projects, WIF money, is that included in that?
Those are all included. And Ms. Appledorn can get that in more detail, but she's been really good about doing apples to apples and looking at the same thing year after year after year and tracking the same items. But yes, it does include all of those things.
Right, thank you.
Yep. Yep. The last point, Madam Chair, and members I'd like to make, and I'd be happy to stand for any other questions, is the question of supplementing versus substitution. In the end, it's probably not a legal question. It's a really difficult question because the state budget is complex. There are lots of different ways to appropriate funds, move funds from one area to another, and those of us who have worked in this for a long time understand those complexities, and because of those complexities, we know that what you see at a snapshot is not always simple and clear. But in the end, it's really a question of keeping the faith with the 1.6 million Minnesotans who voted to raise their taxes to do these things, and with the growing numbers of Minnesotans who support the Legacy Amendment and support the work that it's done. It's really about the legislature and the administration, those that pass the appropriations and those that implement them and then recommend the budgets. It's about them keeping faith with those voters, and so that we can all stand up and say with a straight face, yes, this is being done properly. The funds are being allocated as they should be, consistent with the amendment, and no, we're not substituting. And we'll talk about that in more detail today, but in the end, I think the question we want to put out before the committee is, we need to talk about this because you are really entrusted with this responsibility. In the end, it's the actions of this legislature that are probably the most important in determining whether or not we're substituting or supplanting and whether or not we'll be able to keep the faith with those 1.6 million Minnesotans going forward. And Madam Chair, those are all my comments.
Okay. We want to move now to Ms. Appledorn.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. My name is Cheryl Appledorn. I'm a policy analyst for Conservation Minnesota, and like Steve said, for a number of years I particularly worked on their budget analysis. Since 2002, Conservation Minnesota has performed an annual analysis of Minnesota's budget for conservation and environment. With the passage of the Legacy Amendment in 2008, we also now analyze the impact of those new dollars on those conservation budgets. Because we look at all five primary conservation agencies, and because our goal is to track trends from year to year on an apples-to-apples basis, we look at agency spending. We don't generally go down to the level of individual programs, so therefore our analysis are more of a macro look at how we're doing in terms of conservation funding, and we're not an audit or a report on effectiveness. It's that macro look. But there are several trends that we've found that we thought might be helpful to this committee as you consider the impact of Clean Water Fund on Minnesota's water programs and on the issue of substitution. So I'm just going to touch on three of those themes or trends. In your packet, you have a copy of our most recent report, which looks like this, and you also have a one-page handout, which looks like this. It has some green and blue charts on it, and I'll be referring to the charts in the handout. The first thing I'd like to talk about is that the good news is we believe, having looked at funding for many, many years, that legacy funds have successfully increased the overall state investment in conservation and clean water. There is an increased investment. It's that the idea that there's more funding than we had in 2008 that Steve referenced. However, we think it's really important to keep the increase in perspective. So as you see in Figure 1, total conservation spending as a percent of total state spending, you can see the addition of the legacy funds beginning in 2010, and you do see the significant increase in investment. But you can also see that because we had had the decline during the decade following about 2001, the addition of the legacy funds have really served to primarily put us back to a level that is more similar to what we used to be at. Following on from the downward slide. And figure two is a different slide, but it makes the same point. So figure two is conservation dollars, total spending for conservation agencies in actual dollars, not a percentage, but showing them with an inflation adjustment. And when you look at them that way as well, you see the really the same point, that beginning in 2010, 2011, with the addition of legacy funds, we see an increase, but it's not an exorbitant increase. It's helping us get back to the type of level of funding that we were, say, a decade or 13, 14 years ago. So on the backside of that handout, my second point picks up on Steve's comments regarding the importance of preserving general funds. If it is very clear that if we allow general funds for conservation and environment to erode, that increase that we see, especially in Figure 1, could easily slip away. Figure 3 on the sheet shows the percentage of state general funds spent on conservation and environment. Now, one thing to note in this chart is that we're talking about very small percentages. Prior to 2001, conservation had varied for many years, and I have data going back 30 years on this, but prior to 2001, conservation and environment pretty very typically occupied about 2% of the state's general fund spending. Beginning in the 2000s, we started to see that erode, and by 2008, when the legacy amendment passed, we were down to 1%, as Steve mentioned. So following the passage of the amendment, we've been trying to hold on to those to preserve that existing base of funding, but we have still seen some decline in that percentage. The first couple of years, a little bit of a dip. In 2003, we saw some actual increases, primarily and including some significant increases for groundwater management. 2013, I'm sorry. And so we see the dollars going up, but the overall percentage of state spending is still slipping, which indicates to us that while there's improvement, which is greatly needed and appreciated, conservation as an area has not benefited proportionately compared to the rest of state spending. So this is something, in our view, we just need to watch. It's a little bit of a, maybe not a red flag, maybe a yellow flag, something worth keeping our eye on. And the goal, again, is with an eye towards preserving general funds so that they remain a mix, part of the mix in Figure 1, so that we still continue to see that increased overall investment in conservation and environment. My last point, very quickly.
Well, let me just ask, Representative Torkelson, sorry.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. I just think it's worth spending a little bit more time looking at the difference between total state spending and general fund spending. It's quite dramatic, and instead of asking you pointed questions, I'll just try to ask you to kind of explain that in the way you see it, why those changes occurred over time, and just what they do represent.
We see a
quite dramatic fall off in general fund spending, but we see a much more level chart when it comes to total state spending. And I think there's some migration from general fund to non-general fund, but I would like you to kind of explain that in your words.
Madam Chair, Representative, I think you're exactly right, Representative Torkelson. There has been some movement between general fund and dedicated funds, but it doesn't explain completely the drop-off in general fund. The drop-off in general fund, is general fund is the dollars that can be moved around. So in difficult budget times, those are the dollars that are going to be shifted away into other areas of government. And I think that that's what we saw for a number of years. There's no blame here. We're just making the point that that trend was one of the things that did lead people, lead to a level of concern and led to the passage of the amendment. And we did see it also in total spending. On the chart that I have here, it's just a difference in the scale of the chart, but we saw a decline in total spending as well, not as dramatically as the loss of general fund, but the loss of general fund contributed to that because, of course, general fund is part of total fund spending. So that's a subset.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. But certainly you would agree, I think, that there are certain funds that used to be part of general fund that have migrated to the non-general fund side of state spending. And I'm thinking of DNR in particular. I don't have a list or anything, but
there were definitely some pieces of that. And that accounts for, you're absolutely correct, I'm sorry, Madam Chair, that would account for part, but it doesn't account for at all. And we do have information. We've tracked the base general fund cuts to the agencies over the period of time that we've done this report, and they're very substantial, and they're a very big part of this.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. Just so then, if that's not the case, then what accounts for the total state spending side of this prior to legacy funds passing? There is a decrease, I agree, but it's a very small percentage. It's less than 0.5% the way it looks. If it's not a migration of funds from general fund to non-general fund spending, then what is it?
I am sorry, Madam Chair, Representative Tarkas, I missed the beginning.
Well, we know the total state spending has grown dramatically during this time. So are there new non-general fund funds being spent on environment, or
are you looking? I'm sorry, Madam Chair. Are you looking at the blue chart?
No. I'm looking. There's on Figure One. There's a slight decrease in state spending, but we know that during that time, total state spending increased dramatically. So, what accounts for? You'd think this would fall off just as dramatically as the general fund if we weren't migrating funds. I'm getting too far into the
weeds. No. Madam Chair, that's a good question. I think the difference is that they're in the conservation agencies, and we include MPCA, DNR. There are other dedicated funds which are more stable, the game and fish fees, other things like that. So those were not as impacted by the budget cuts during that period of time. That's a stabilizing factor in total state funding. But the loss of the general fund was one of the drivers in the loss of total state spending. I hope that answers your question. So the last point we want to make is on Figure 4. It relates to the third of the principles that Steve talked to, is the importance of bonding to conservation and environment. And Figure 4 is the chart that shows the biennial average of bonding that's gone to conservation and environment. And there you can see the historic averages. And the yellow bar at the very end, 2013-14, includes the governor's proposal, capital investment proposal for 2014, which was pretty low at 14.5%. I would note, I haven't had time to update this chart, but Chair Hausman's Bill 3250, recently introduced, would bring the biennial bonding for conservation of water programs up to 18%, which would be much closer to that historic range. And so if this is the type of thing, I don't think that Steve or MEP were not suggesting that 22% is a line in the sand every year, but that it should be a goal over a period of years. And so we're glad to see that percentage come closer to the historic range.
I think Representative Murphy had a question.
Madam Chair, Ms. Appledorn, I was just thinking about what you said, there's no blame. But why not? Why isn't there any blame?
Madam Chair, Representative, I'm just a numbers cruncher, and so Our goal when we started, when Conservation Minnesota started doing this report, we did it because we really felt, although the legislature has outstanding fiscal staff, the way that dollars are reported doesn't always help everyone understand the trends, especially over a number of years in what's happening to the funding for these agencies. And so we really wanted to focus on and prepare a report that could be repeated year after year that would help us see some of these trends. And that's all we're trying to do.
Okay. Representative Pasman?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I think we'd still want to go over a bill with you line by line because we think you missed some things that we think are also conservation related.
That was going to be my question. How do you make these definitions and how do we?
Madam Chair,
there things that are missed or added or whatever?
Madam Chair, Representative, on page 23 of the actual report, which is back in the attachments, you can see our historic spreadsheet. And there is clearly some decisions and choices that have to be made. If you're going to try to repeat something year after year after year, you have to make some decisions and stick to them. And so that's what we've done. So we do not include in our percentage of bonding, we do not address transit, as important as that is to conservation and environment. We don't include it. It just was a choice that had to be made. We also don't include energy-related projects. These are choices that have just been made. We do, as Representative Erdahl inquired about, we do include all funding for PFA. And we've made decisions, really tried to make decisions at a higher agency level so that we don't have to get into the weeds too much. But we would be delighted to sit down and go through any bills and see if there are individual projects, local projects particularly, that maybe could be considered as being added to the percentage.
What about issues like trails funding?
Trails funding is all in there, Madam Chair.
All parks and trails, metro and state.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Okay.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Chair, members.
Okay, next is... Okay. Daryl Gerber is next. And Michael Schmidt.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Daryl Gerber, and I'm the Water Program Coordinator at Clean Water Action in Minnesota. And I wanted to just take a few minutes this afternoon to kind of highlight a few things specifically about the Clean Water Fund and in some ways set the stage for a little bit more focused discussion by Mike, and in some ways kind of a Clean Water Fund 101 to build on Steve's history and background on that. First of all, the Clean Water Fund is, within the statute, is designated to be spent only to protect, enhance, and restore water quality in lakes, rivers, and streams, and to protect groundwater from degradation. And this, you know, as you well know, this covers a tremendous scope, and it also includes many issues that the legislature has already heard about. One of the basic and fundamental uses for the Clean Water Fund is addressing the tremendous backlog of work to restore our surface waters. And this is one of the things that Steve mentioned was one of the original impetus for looking at the Clean Water Legacy Act. And these waters that are do not meet the water quality standards are reported every 2 years to the EPA via something that's called the Impaired Waters List. I know it's been brought to the legislature for review every 2 years. The draft 2014 list contains over 4,000 waters in Minnesota that are impaired, which is a little more than 500 have been added since the 2002 list, and it also includes 30 that have been cleaned up and thus delisted. And this highlights a kind of important thing about the process that is used when really looking at these waters, and there are kind of four real key steps. The first one is this assessment, so going out, gathering the data, and using it to determine which of the waters meet water quality standards. And Minnesota had been way behind on really doing this, and that was a big part of the Clean Water Legacy Act in 2006. since then, you know, we have started doing that 10-year cycle, which the committee has heard about and I believe is going to be part of the PCA testimony later. But that's a process we're a little bit over halfway through of getting through all of the 81 major watersheds. And from the Clean Water Fund, about 14% of the appropriations so far have gone into doing that very key basic step, which is to really accelerate this assessment and monitoring to catch up. The next step after you find out which ones are impaired is to do the planning, or really that deeper analysis to determine where the pollution loads are coming from and what reductions are needed to restore those water so that they meet the water quality standards, or make sure that they continue to meet those standards if they're already. About 13% of the Clean Water Funds are going to increase work on that to also catch up from where we were behind. The Clean Water Accountability Act that was passed last year also puts the state on a pathway to really even do this even a little more efficiently and effectively by the new thing called the Watershed Restoration and Protection Strategies, or WRAPS, which you folks have heard a number of times. And this uses a more common sense approach by really approaching this on a watershed-wide basis instead of kind of piecemeal. And it also helps be able to feed in better to another new thing called the One Watershed, One Plan, which we're really looking at both of these new policies that the legislature has put in place to make it so that that state and local governments can get more of this planning done faster, as well as create better plans that tie in better to the next step, which is the third one is implementation. And so this is the real shovels in the ground portion, where we go from those plans to the actual work to restore and protect our waters. And about 54% of the Clean Water Fund has been used about this, plus about some portion of 14%, which is on drinking water source protection. The last step really is kind of tying it all together, and that's the monitoring. So that's where we go back and we finish that 10-year cycle, and we come back to these waters again and make sure that we are on the right pathway. Are there new problems that need to be addressed, or do we need to adjust where we have been? And as you can see, there's a lot of work that is done to get to our clean water goals, which was the purpose of the Clean Water Fund. And there are also a lot of challenges along the way, which you know, there's a lot to highlight that you have all focused on over the past. One of them is that there is the difference between point sources and non-point sources. The point sources are basically those that you can think of as the pollution comes from a pipe. Those are regulated pretty well and have been addressed pretty well through discharge permits, which give regulators a direct tool in order to ensure that the pollution reductions are met. The other side of it, though, is unfortunately that one of the largest source of pollution now into Minnesota's waters come from those unregulated point sources. And unfortunately, those require, we rely almost entirely on voluntary measures to meet those reductions. Another challenge is that we really, the need is far exceeds the available resources. In other words, we can't really buy ourselves out of this. And we don't really have a full picture right now of saying, okay, by the end of this, how much is it going to cost to entirely get clean water? But I think there are some hints that we can see. The one was the PCA report in 2003 that kind of threw out a kind of first guess of how much it would take to restore waters impaired by non-point sources. And they estimated $600 million to $3 billion. A lot has changed since then, so you know there's only so much stock you can put in that number. But even looking at the PFA 2014 request for the stormwater and wastewater treatment improvements, there's about almost $1.3 billion in projects that are listed in there. And of course, all of that is not appropriate to be covered by the Clean Water Fund. In fact, probably a small portion, but just to really set the scope of, you know, the issue that we're talking about out there. There's also a lot that we have learned recently that has come to the legislature as issues like nitrogen pollution and the new understanding about the role of groundwater and agriculture drainage as the role that they play in transporting nitrogen pollution to our surface waters, as well as the pollution in the drinking water sources themselves. And then an entire area of really needing a lot more work is the groundwater quality and quantity concerns. And, you know, as you can see, there are a lot of challenges, and it really the main thing to highlight is just the importance of really being wise about the use of the Clean Water Fund. It sounds like a lot of money, but there is also a lot of need. And the fund has been going to a lot of good projects, which I know that the agencies are going to talk about to a lot greater extent coming up.
If I can make one comment, that there's an I'm glad that Steve Morse is still here. There's just been some new rules issued by the president on EPA and those issues. Is that going to have some effect on what people are doing or able to do?
Madam Chairman and Committee, the new rules just came out yesterday. It was issued by the EPA, and it's addressing some uncertainty about exactly which waters are covered by the Clean Water Act, the Federal Clean Water Act. And I think the thing that makes it really hard to actually answer that is that Minnesota, it is legal and common here for the state statutes and laws and rules to go above and beyond federal.
Okay.
And so it's really some of the impact on the state level is sometimes really hard to actually say how it's going to hit the rubber hits the road. And Ms. Blood may be able to expand on this. It's really new. It just came out yesterday.
Okay.
I would say that some of the things that we can look at is it does have some new exemptions for agricultural practices in it that we need to really take a look at.
Now, do those preempt state laws, or is this a state law, how is it written?
It would apply to permits for dredge and fill that go to the Corps of Engineers, and it exempts some of the practices, the BMPs, that conservation measures that would improve water quality. And I'm not at a point now to really say if that's in our opinion, if that's a good thing or a bad thing, but it's kind of a new thing that is added in there this time around.
Usually when you hear exemption, it sounds like it's bad. This might not be bad.
Madam Chair and Committee, it is practices that they have looked at and said will improve water quality. So,
okay, and then how, just the relationship between the federal and state? Does the federal always allow for different state? Does it allow for the state to be better but not worse? What is
Madam Chair and Committee, the EPA and the federal rule, it's kind of a cooperative federalism approach where the federal government will allow the states to go above and beyond. And, in fact, they often give delegated authority to the state in order to enforce the Clean Water Act. And in Minnesota, that has been delegated to the PCA.
Okay. Representative Torkelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Mr. Gerber, for being here today. Do you have any information as to how Minnesota compares to other states in our progress in testing and monitoring and designating waters for the Clean Water Act?
Madam Chair and member, I don't have any updated information on that to really be able to relate to you. We've been right about in the average. What I don't know is if we have gotten better than the average yet.
Thank you.
Okay. Representative Rudolph.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. We have an ongoing survey on the quality of our lakes and streams, and you were throwing a lot of percentages and information. I just want to make sure that if you've given it, I've got it right. What percent of our lakes and streams have now been surveyed, and of that, what percent are impaired?
I didn't give that, Madam Chair and committee member at all?
Could you repeat it?
Okay, I'd like to know what percent of our lakes and streams have been surveyed, and of that, what percent are impaired?
Yeah, Madam Chair and committee members, I don't have that information that I gave here, and actually that might be a really good question for the PCA testifier.
Get ready for that one.
Yeah.
Okay. Yes.
Madam Chair, yes. Committee members, thank you for having me here today. My name is Michael Schmidt. I am the Water Quality Associate at the Minnesota Center for Environmental Advocacy. And I'm going to get into a little bit more detail in terms of possible areas of substitution that we have seen in looking at some of the appropriations that have been made over the last several years under the Legacy Amendment. So this is a smaller scale look that complements the kind of macro level look that Ms. Appledorn and Senator Morse referenced. So there are several programs that, at least on their face, appear to have or raise the issue of substitution. And I believe there's a handout that looks like this that I hope you have. So this chart lists Clean Water Partnership funding and Ag BMP funding. So the Clean Water Partnership program has traditionally been funded through the general fund and sometimes from other sources. I noticed in the Conservation Minnesota report, it's also listed on page 23. So it does receive funding from other sources traditionally. And as you can see on the chart, from 2010 to 2011, that biennium to the next biennium, there is a significant drop in general funding. I believe is about an 80% drop, which is much larger than the overall general fund cut. And at that same time, the program received clean water funding, and by 2014-2015, the upcoming biennium, the total amount is very similar to what it had in 2008-2009 before the Clean Water Fund was put in place. So at least on its face, this gives the impression that it could be substituting clean water funding for the existing general funding that it had been traditionally receiving each year. The Ag BMP program provides funding for best management practices, that's the BMP part, for agriculture. So it's a loan program that has a revolving loan, and so the amount of the total loan that can be given out has gradually increased through general fund appropriations. So general funding was one of the primary sources. Federal sources also provided some support for the program. And as you can see, in 2008-2009, it's a little bit hard to see in black and white, but the bottom chunk there is general funding. And in the subsequent biennium, that was essentially replaced by the Clean Water Fund. So this is another instance where, at least on its face, it appears to be the Clean Water Fund replacing what had been a regular source of funding for the program.
You know, the supplement and not supplant is a constitutional requirement. And has any of you groups thought to file a complaint, or better yet, a lawsuit?
Madam Chair, members, we believe that the legislature is probably the best place to resolve this and best equipped to make sure that substitution does not occur, at least going forward. And so we just wanted to highlight these issues to make sure that going forward the legislature looks at the issue and does not substitute. So we've not looked at any other avenues at this point.
Do you have more faith in the legislature than some of us do?
Madam Chair, we may. I guess we'll see. Another area that we've looked at that is a little bit less clear-cut is funding for septic systems. There was a drop in general funding for septic system programs and upgrades at the same time as the Clean Water Fund began funding those programs. That issue is a little bit harder to evaluate because there are a number of fees and different sources of funding for septic systems. So I don't have a chart for that one because the fees over time are a little bit difficult to evaluate. And then there are several other programs that are harder to evaluate where it's not a primary traditional source of funding that at least on its face appears to be supplanted by other funding. So these include TMDL limits and NPDES permits. So these are permit limits for wastewater discharges that are set to comply with the water cleanup plans that Senator Morse and Mr. Gerber mentioned. Traditionally, those have been funded through permit fees, and now some clean water funding is going toward those. So it's possible that that is supplementing and not supplanting, but it's a little bit hard to tell. Similarly, inflow and infiltration has traditionally received funding from local government and sometimes from bonding, and that has begun to receive clean water funding. So that's another case where it may be supplementing, but it would be helpful to have additional information to evaluate that. Groundwater pollution monitoring has also traditionally been funded through fees, pesticide fees, and fertilizer application fees. So the idea for those was to avoid externalizing the costs. For example, for pesticides, there may be public health impacts. So it's attempting to internalize the cost of monitoring for the things that are being applied by charging a fee for that. And there's some funding from the Clean Water Fund going toward those. And again, that may be supplementing, but it would be helpful to have additional information. There are several reasons that these potential areas of substitution are important. As Mr. Gerber mentioned, the water quality needs are very significant. We have thousands of impaired waters, and they're being delisted very slowly. So we can't afford to backfill existing programs. We need to add more to accelerate the cleanup process. There are also public expectations for the money. As Senator Morse mentioned, we hope that the legislature keeps the faith with the voters who supported the amendment and who now support the amendment as that support increases to ensure that by the end of the constitutionally dedicated money in 20 years, we do have dramatically cleaner water and dramatically increase the rate of delisting of impaired waters. So in 20 years, we hope to be able to say that the legislature and the state funding has abided by the Constitution and we've been careful stewards of the public investments. So in 20 years, success would mean much cleaner water, dramatically fewer impairments, dramatically increased delistings of those waters that fail to meet standards. And as I mentioned before, the legislature is in a unique position to evaluate substitution and avoid it. And there have been a number of potential approaches that have been suggested. The legislative auditor issued a report in 2011 with a couple of suggestions that included having recipients of funding explain why the funding that they receive goes above and beyond to supplement rather than substitute. Receiving information or budget information from MMB or having MMB keep information so that you can compare very easily between the traditional sources of funding and the Clean Water Fund, and possibly having staff flag areas where there might be potential substitution or issues like that. So evaluating these substitution issues will help ensure that over the next 20 years, while we have the legacy amendment, it leads to cleaner water and the citizens of Minnesota will benefit from those improvements. Thank you.
Okay. Any questions? Okay. Thank you. Okay. We've got a half an hour left, and we have got 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 people. So, sorry. We'll try. And Rebecca Flood is the next person, Assistant Commissioner from Pollution Control Agency. I know the first people get a big advantage, but great name for working on water.
Isn't it?
Yes. Okay. Ms. Flood.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you for having me here today. My name is Rebecca Flood. I'm an assistant commissioner and do water policy at the Pollution Control Agency. With me also is Jeff Freeman, the executive director at the Public Facilities Authority, and Sarah Stroman, who is the acting deputy director at the Board of Water and Soil Resources. So we would like to talk to you about what we've been able to accomplish with just the last 4 years of funding from the Clean Water Fund and where we might identify gaps. As you know, the purpose of the constitutional amendment and the dedicated sales tax receipts that go into the Clean Water Fund is to provide a long-term, stable source of funding to achieve clean water for Minnesota. Minnesota Statute Chapter 114D.50 establishes the Clean Water Fund and specifies uses of the fund, including monitoring and assessment, development of total maximum daily loads, or TMDLs, as well as what was passed last year in legislation, Watershed Restoration and Protection Strategies, or RAPs. Also, Clean Water Fund dollars can go to grants and loans for both point and non-point source implementation. And lastly, the funds can go to state agencies to carry out these responsibilities. To do that, I will highlight the development and implementation of our statewide watershed approach, which includes monitoring and assessing the condition of our waters, developing those TMDLs and RAPs for those TMDLs for those waters that don't meet water quality standards, and the protection strategies for those waters that do meet standards. And then Jeff and Sarah will talk about implementation issues. So this map illustrates Minnesota's watershed approach. And as I mentioned, Minnesota Statute 114D is what establishes a 10-year cycle to monitor and assess all each one of the 81 major watersheds in the state, and each one of them undergo an intensive monitoring and identification of what factors are stressing aquatic communities in our rivers, lakes, and streams. So once we have that information, we then develop watershed protection watershed restoration and protection strategy document. So all of the scientific information that we collect is plugged into a computer model tailored to the actual physical conditions within each one of the watersheds. This model platform contains numerous data layers so that once we add the specific information, the model tells us what areas are contributing the greatest amount of pollutants to these particular watersheds. This information is detailed and technical, but we really want them to be useful documents to our local partners, those who implement various on-the-ground activities. So we've taken this very technical information and developed these higher-level watershed restoration and protection strategies so that they can actually be useful to our local partners and help identify areas that are contributing the highest amount of pollutants within their local watersheds. So the local partners will be able to target our Clean Water Fund dollars to get the biggest bang for the bucks, whether it's through programs like the ones that our other speakers are going to be talking about, or, for example, a new state program, the Ag Water Quality Certification Program, that's in its pilot stage. In addition, Clean Water Fund has provided dollars to do special studies, like the nitrogen study that was released this past June. This study was based on over 5,000 water quality samples. We and our study partners were able to identify major sources of nitrogen to our surface waters. So once we know that information, we can then either use our existing programs to address these issues, accelerate those programs, or design new programs to help reduce these pollutant sources. Measuring the outcomes of Clean Water Fund investments is happening at a number of scales. We have an interagency team that puts together this Clean Water Performance Report, a copy, a scorecard of which is provided to you in your packet. These highlight the state's progress on 18 selected measures for surface water, groundwater, and financial investments. The 18 measures included in the report are a subset of 50 broader measures identified by the team as being important to track over the life of the constitutional amendment. In addition, each individual agency program also has a number of measures to track their individual agency performance. And you can find more information about this on the LCC website. And in that, you can also find specific projects that are identified and how clean water funds have gone to those projects. Restoring and protecting our waters is a joint effort of state partner agencies, including the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency, the Department of Natural Resources, the Department of Agriculture, Department of Health, the Board of Water and Soil Resources, the Public Facilities Authority, and the Metropolitan Council. As partners, we've developed a coordinated, efficient approach to protecting and restoring the state's waters, and funds have been allocated among these agencies to support many different types of activities. And I wanted to actually mention at this point, in response to Representative Erdahl's question, about 60% of our water bodies have been monitored around the state, and 43. So then once we gather that information, we then assess whether or not waters are meeting our water quality standards. So 60% of them have been monitored, 43% of them have actually completed assessments. And I'll turn it over at this particular point to Mr. Freeman.
Thank you. So, Madam Chair, so Ms. Flood, what percent are impaired?
About 40% of the waters currently are impaired statewide.
Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The same question I had for Mr. Gerber, how do we compare other states?
In terms of impairments?
In terms of enacting the Clean Water Act.
When I travel and meet with my counterparts around the country, actually I think we're probably well ahead of any other state in the United States in terms of assessing, in terms of meeting the conditions of the Clean Water Act, which require us to do monitoring and assessment, to develop TMDLs, and to do various restoration activities. When I tell my counterparts that we get about $80 to $90 million a year through the Clean Water Fund, it's jaw-dropping to them. So we are great beneficiaries of in this state of the citizens of the United of the state being able to vote to tax themselves more in order for us to protect our water resources. We also have a lot more water than many other states do, and so it's important, I think, for us to use this constitutionally dedicated fund to protect our water resources. So we are very fortunate in this state.
Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Flood, we're 60% have been monitored. Now, what year did that monitoring start? Do you recall?
When the Clean Water Legacy Act was passed in 2006, we received kind of bridge funding in 2007, 8, and 9 in order for us to design the watershed approach and figure out how we were going to go about monitoring and assessing all the waters in the state on a 10-year rotating basis. So we conducted a couple of pilots during that time period until the constitutional amendment was passed in 2008.
Okay, thank you, Madam Chair. The point I want to make is that it seems it was going at an extremely slow rate back a few years ago, and that one of the positive outcomes of the legacy amendment has been that this accelerated the process a great deal. Is that correct?
Madam Chair, Representative Erdahl, I think I've heard others refer to it as putting our monitoring program on steroids. So it absolutely has accelerated what was monitoring that was going at a glacial pace.
Thank you. Madam Chair and members, again, my name is Jeff Freeman. I'm the director of the Public Facilities Authority. And to start with, I would like to just briefly describe our traditional programs for funding water, wastewater and stormwater infrastructure. These are programs that do not receive any of the Clean Water Legacy funds. Our largest program is the Clean Water Revolving Fund. This is a revolving loan fund that is capitalized by annual federal grants and 20% state match that has been appropriated through state general obligation bonds, the bonding bill. The federal and state monies are leveraged by loan repayments and PFA revenue bonds that we sell separate from the state GO bonds to make low interest loans to cities. Since the beginning of the program, each $1 of state funds has generated over $13 in project construction and more than $3 of interest savings, because these are loans are made at below market interest rates. Average loan capacity of the fund right now is about $150 million a year. To give you an example of for FY14, we will receive about $25 million of federal funds to help capitalize the fund, about $5 million of state match, and we expect that this year we will our total loans will be about $130 to $150 million. Yeah. So then the programs that we have that are funded through Clean Water Legacy Funds, there are two programs. Point Source Implementation Grants. These are grants for 50% of eligible costs to help cities meet TMDL requirements and water quality-based effluent limits. And when I say eligible costs, we're talking about only the additional incremental costs that are directly related to meeting a higher water quality standard, the TMDL waste load reduction or the water quality-based effluent limit. It's only that additional level of funding to provide the infrastructure to meet those additional higher standards. These grants leverage additional funds from the state revolving loans and as well as local funds that are used for the other 50% of the eligible costs, as well as other system rehab and replacement costs that may be done at the same time. A lot of times for efficiency, a city will do the treatment upgrade as part of a rehab and replacement of existing infrastructure at the same time. But the grants, the point source implementation grants, are only for those specific costs related to meeting the new standards. And then our other program funded through Clean Water Legacy Funds is a small community wastewater treatment program. The focus here is on very small unsewered communities, oftentimes less than 30 households. The program provides technical assistance grants up to $40,000, construction loans and grants up to $2 million. Oh, and I apologize, I should mention back to the PSIG or point source grants, I have a mistake on the slide. The FY14-15 appropriation was actually $18 million, not 20 as shown. And for the small community program, the appropriation was $4 million. So I had the total right, but I was off on the breakdown. I apologize for that. So just to kind of repeat or go a little deeper on the difference between the funding. The Clean Water Fund supplements the traditional funding programs. The traditional funding programs, the revolving fund loans and the WIF grants, are primarily focused on infrastructure replacement and rehabilitation. These are expensive systems, and like any other infrastructure, it wears out over time, and cities continually have to make additional investments to maintain that infrastructure. The Clean Water Legacy funding is appropriated to the two specific programs that I mentioned to target projects that to address specific water quality objectives. Treatment plant upgrades that are needed to meet requirements for TMDL waste load allocations and more stringent effluent limits, and also unsewered communities with failing septic systems, including oftentimes raw sewage discharges.
Okay.
This slide and map show the projects that we have funded from 2010 through 2013 with the dedicated Clean Water Legacy Funds. The map, a little hard to see here, but this is the same map that is in the most recent performance report that's available online, and if you want to look at it more closely. But the projects have been 22 wastewater projects to reduce phosphorus discharges to 1 milligram per liter or less, 3 wastewater projects to reduce mercury discharges, 4 stormwater projects to reduce phosphorus and TSS, total suspended solids discharges, 11 wastewater construction projects for unserved communities, and 20 technical assistance projects in unserved communities to help them do the feasibility studies to figure out what they need to do to solve the problem. The identified needs there are put just in relation to the current 2014 project priority list. We have 30 eligible projects for the point source implementation grants on the current list, grant need of about $23.5 million. We don't award grants until projects are ready to start construction, and so many of these projects are right now, a few have been awarded already, many others are in the process of getting their approvals and bidding this spring and will be going to construction. Also, you can see 32 unserved community projects on the current priority list. So these are the projects that we know of on the current list. However, PCA, the Pollution Control Agency, has identified cities that are expected to receive new permit requirements in the coming years, the coming decade. And so we watch that list closely. Those will be eligible for point source implementation grants in the future. And as those come online, we'll get them on the list. And it oftentimes takes a number of years for the projects to actually be ready for construction. There's a lot of planning and design work, engineering work, to prepare those projects for construction. And the funds are what allow, the Clean Water Legacy Funds are really what allows or provides the incentive for cities to get those projects built more quickly and to achieve those water quality benefits.
Okay.
Madam Chairman, again, I'm Sarah Stroman, Acting Deputy Director with the Board of Water and Soil Resources. I'm going to go through an overview fairly quickly here because I have some folks from Stearns, SWCD, and South Washington Watershed District, and I think their stories will illustrate better than I can how these local units of government are using clean water funds on top of federal and local funds to clean up Minnesota's waters, as well as some of the gaps that still exist. So just very briefly, Bowser's Clean Water Fund goal, the goal of our program is to help meet statewide water quality goals through the prevention and reduction of non-point source pollution. We do this primarily through a competitive grants program and a conservation easement program. This map shows an overview of the projects we have completed to date, and I should mention I'm going to focus primarily on the grants program here, not the easements program. This shows the totality, more than 2,000 projects that have been funded via Bowser between 2010 and 2013, along with the estimated pollution reductions associated with those projects by major basin. To look at this a little bit more closely, just in terms of what we funded this year in 2014, we funded 40 projects that addressed 28 impairments. And you can see here this chart shows the phosphorus, sediment, and nitrogen reduction estimated associated with those projects. So about 18,000 pounds per year phosphorus reduction, 18,000 tons per year sediment reduction, and 4,800 pounds per year nitrogen reduction. To put this in a little bit of context, we can look at 4,800 pounds per year nitrogen reduction. To put this in a little bit of context, we can look at these reduction estimates in relationship to statewide goals as outlined in the draft nutrient reduction strategy. And so if you look at this chart, again, these are just the Bowser-funded 2014 projects there in the dark blue compared to the green bar, which is that statewide goal. So if we look at the phosphorus, that statewide goal, the 2025 goal, is 1.1 million pounds of phosphorus. The Bowser projects in this 2014 would meet 2% of that goal. Overall, if we looked at cumulatively, we're at about 5% of that goal. As you probably see, this is a little bit of a difficult way to roll this up statewide, and that's why I want to get to some of these examples, because I think they will help illustrate how we can measure the outcomes from these various practices. But what I think this does illustrate is the significant need that still exists out there in terms of cleaning up the waters. Another way we look at illustrating the need or the gaps is through the demand for dollars that we see at the Board of Water and Soil Resources. So this chart just shows the 2014 competitive grant applications, the number of applications we received versus the number we were able to award, and then the number of the amount of dollars requested versus the amount of dollars we had to award. And you'll see that there's quite a difference here. I do want to note that the applications we receive represent just the local government's one or two top priorities. It's not a laundry list of everything they could do. It really is their top priority. So it is more a representation of need and not a laundry list. What I wanted to show here is just that this trend has existed since the start of the Clean Water Fund. So when we started granting dollars in 2010, this shows through 2013. And if you just focus on the teal colored bars, you'll see again the amount requested far exceeds the amount awarded. And finally, I just wanted to mention that this year we had a new grant program that focused in on targeted watersheds. These were areas where the problem was well-defined, the solution was well-defined, wow, and folks who applied could measure their progress and make progress. And even in that kind of situation where the problem and the goals are very well-defined, our request for dollars far exceeded the amount that we had available to appropriate, and our board today just did make awards to the first three targeted watersheds under this program. So that program is just getting underway, but I think this helps illustrate the need and the gap that is still out here. I think with that, Madam Chair, I would like to bring up our two local folks who are here from Stearns, SWCD, and South Washington Watershed District, and they can illustrate this a little bit further with some of their work.
I know the problem is we're really running out of time, so I think we ought to hold comments for a minute, hear a little bit from the two local folks, point out the handouts that we have, and see what we can get in.
Madam Chair?
So.
Will all of them stick around, please, for questions?
Yes. Then? Yep.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. My name is Dennis Brooks, administrator with the Stearns County Soil and Water Conservation District, and I'm going to rip through 68 slides fairly quickly.
Ready to go.
Okay. Thank you.
I'm going to talk a little bit about our lakes. We got almost 300 lakes in Stearns County alone, and we're also the number one ag county in Minnesota. So that makes for a potent combination of protecting our resources and maintaining productive soils. We find out, I'm going to cover a little bit about some of the hurdles, including the cost share, the participation in critical areas, and how we have folks on the lake living that have farmers up above that are contributing to their problem. We find out about these problems by driving around the county, other folks that are interested in letting us know, including other state agencies, and we create a database to maintain a list of these folks. These are folks that have been identified here on the map of with resource concerns. One of the lakes is Bullfing Lake. It's got two channels that outlet through a lakeshore owner property. This one includes 7 landowners and 2 are Lakeshore residents and 5 are farmers. In the targeted area, we're looking at approximately 453-acre drainage area with lots of sediment occurring. There's the gully that you can see approaching the lake. There's the delta forming in the lake. There's a dock behind that sediment. Can you imagine waking up in the morning and not being able to see your dock? Another area is North Browns Lake. We got 11 landowners here, 1 lakeshore, 3 residential, 7 agriculture in the targeted area, a little over 300 acres in drainage area. And again, we're seeing excessive amount of sediment. This highlights the watershed area. There's the gully. And again, we're having a tremendous amount of soil being moved off the landscape into the lake. Two Rivers Lake, another area of concern in Stearns County. We've got severe field erosion. Another major concern is loss of field productivity and the sediment nutrients entering Two River Lake. Here's some of the erosion slides. Some of these events that you see are from recent activity where we're seeing more dramatic storm events earlier in the year before we get the farmer gets the crop up and protecting the soil with the canopy. And some of these are new farmers. They have taken over from their dad and mom, and son or daughter are now experiencing these type of rain events that they haven't experienced in the past, which makes it even more difficult to manage these areas. So these are the hurdles. Here's one special site. We had Cedar Island Lake. We have about 450 acres that drain into an area that is eroding, causing big washouts. 7 landowners. It's a mix of clay loam, loam soils. It's got high crop productivity index. And we coordinated a meeting with these farmers to work with them. This is the actual outlet of the area before it was... It blew out. They fixed it, and this is what they fixed it with, and this is the road. And then after another major event, it blew out again. So what we need to do is store water up in the watershed. And there are 7 landowners, and these are potential sites where we could store water, the gold color. And we presented a number of options to these landowners. One are permanent storage options. We're looking at permanent conservation easements like RIM. We also looked at temporary storage using CRP with a 10 or 15-year contract, and then also water and sediment basins with 24 to 36 hours of storage. We also looked at crop residue, cover crops, grass waterways, et cetera. Feedback from producers was not positive. You know, they spend a tremendous amount of time creating these areas for ag production, and they were not excited to be putting it back into grasses. And then taking a look at the landscape from 1938 to 2010, the next slide is 1938. And you can see there's a fair amount of shrubs, trees. Those little dots are probably bales of some type, so there's some type of grassland production. This is what it looks like now. In order to maintain their profitability on the farm, they did what was necessary to maintain that by clearing some of those areas to grow crops that are profitable. Hurdles of financial assistance. We're a big ag county. We are very tightly aligned with the United States Department of Agriculture, NRCS. We're co-located with them. Looking at the funds coming in from 2009 to 2012, there's almost $14 million into Stearns County. You can see the part that is EQIP, that's the USDA Environmental Quality Incentive Program, and then the Conservation Stewardship Program. They're both USDA programs, and you can see it's been a tremendous asset to our landowners in leveraging those dollars along with the Bowser State Cost Share and Clean Water Legacy Funds. And the pie chart there to the lower right just shows how many of these dollars have been used for erosion. We also have over 2,000 feedlots in Stearns County, and some of those had feedlot runoff problems. We've been addressing those at an accelerated rate to make sure that we don't have the nutrients and bacteria entering our surface waters, and then also assisting farmers with nutrient management plans. Looking at the cost share through EQIP, you can see the 75% rate isn't attained with the EQIP, the Environmental Quality Incentive Program funds, and that's where it's nice to leverage clean water funds if it's possible. Now, that was a lot of gloom and doom. I want to move quickly into some success stories. These are the common practices listed there, everything from water and sediment basins, the grass waterways, to buffers, to water control structures, crop residue management, et cetera. This first project was on a lake where we had a gully.
The problem is we are not only out of time, but there's another committee coming in.
Okay.
So we kind of need to maybe just point out a few issues.
Okay.
We also
move to the final. As you can see, these projects had tremendous pollutant load reductions too.
Yeah.
It's kind of like a movie now instead of a presentation. Just some of the things here: technical assistance from start to finish. These projects take 100 to 200 hours of staff time. Landowner participation continues to be something that we need more. Knowledge, attitude, and practices, types of work, flexibility with cost share, making sure we have consistency, and maintenance of the project once it's installed, and then educating landowners, continue to educate landowners on the proper procedures.
Yeah.
With that, I'll take it, turn it over to Matt for his...
Okay, I'm sorry, you're just going to have to be able to share some thoughts with us, because we are... We do have to get out. Sorry, I apologize for my bad scheduling, but it's hard to interesting topic. And meanwhile, while we're still here, Representative Ward has looked at the minutes of March 25th and moves the minutes of March 25th. All those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion passes.
Is that your main job in this legislation?
What? Representative Torkelson.
Just very briefly like to note that there are a number of members of the Clean Water Council here today that are showing their deep interest and dedication to the work that they do.
We're obviously going to reschedule this at a more leisurely time. I mean, continue this at a more leisurely time. And we did hand out the letter from the Clean Water Council. So thank you all for all the work you do. Okay, just...
Thank you, Madam Chair.
A few minutes, sorry.
Members, my name is Matt Moore. I'm the... Administrator with South Washington Watershed District, and we're located in the southern one quarter of Washington County, and I think the clean water funds have really impacted our watershed, because we have a strategy of working through our watershed management plan, state approved plan. We have a process to identify projects, go through, do assessment, identify pollutant loading, and then identify projects and move into implementation. So the clean water funds helped us with this Kobe Lake project. We have two projects on Kobe Lake, and the assessment process was able to identify those loading areas, and in order to address the impairment, which is nutrients on Kobe Lake. And so our process gets us through to an assessment and a plan, which identifies projects that we can then move forward with implementation. Some of the examples of those projects are rain gardens that we put in the right-of-way, pond modifications, working with the city and the county on existing projects that they had coming up, and, of course, a reuse project that we have on the golf course. So our rain gardens was a voluntary project working with landowners. You can see there's $150,000 in clean water funds, $275,000 total cost, so about $125,000 local match there. To implement this, a voluntary program, public-private partnership, working with the city to identify good locations in the watershed. Approximately 26 rain gardens were installed over a two-summer period to reduce loading to Kobe Lake. And just a picture of some of the activities and what they turned out looking like. We were able to get the neighbors and some of the families involved as well. Our reuse program is in conjunction with County Road Project, where we're taking public water again, public water into rain gardens off of the streets, public water off of County Road into a pond. Identified a reuse project with the golf course, the City of Woodbury Golf Course, and we're able to design a system where we're taking that water again off of redoing County Road 19, expanding it for safety issues and transportation issues, taking that additional impervious area into the pond and recycling it through the golf course and using it for irrigation. With these two projects, as you can see here, we achieve 100% reduction for Colby Lake from that watershed, from that contributing area. So those dollars really have an impact on our plan and our implementation plan to get those projects on the ground, achieve that goal. Now we can move forward with our next steps in addressing upstream and in-lake issues. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you for the quick speed. Yep. Representative Wiggins.
Well, thank you for doing this, Madam Chair.
I promise we're going to do it at greater length and maybe even go look at some rain gardens when they're in better shape than they are now. Okay. Representative Wiggins.
One of the things that's sitting here troubling me greatly, though, is nobody's mentioned drinking water. This amendment passed because of drinking water. So when we have our next presentation, I hope we start with drinking water.
Representative Wood.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I would also like to just say a little bit different comment than Ms. Chair Wagenius is that, you know, PCA, PFA, Bowser Soil Water Conservation District, in particular the Soil Water Conservation Districts in my district do great, great work. But I often hear that, you know, why do we need so many different water kind of related folks? And I think you folks need to really highlight that. I really do. I think you need to tell us, you know, what do you do differently from the other agencies and why and things like that. So I hope that next time, Madam Chair, that we hear that portion as well, along with drinking water. And then, Mr. Folks, I want to meet with you about a little lake called Big Fish Lake in a minute here, please.
Okay. Okay, again, sorry for the surfeit of information in the short amount of time, but the meeting adjourned.